Okay, guys. Tonight, the first part of tonight's share is a dual share. It's a good share to try to understand Nidos better. But it's also good to learn about demagoguery. What is a demagogue? So let's study a little bit about Korach, and we'll study about how demagogues operate. I know a few good ones myself. Close to one. Good friend of mine. But seriously, the demagoguery that's on display, obviously it's a very extreme form, but there's a mida behind it that everyone possesses and everyone struggles with. So let's start with source number two. We'll get back to source number one in a moment. But source number two, Chazal, very famous medrash, Ashri Ha'ish. Want to see if you can hit the air conditioning button? Mazgan, right over there to the left. If it turns on, does it turn on? Yes, no? Did it turn on? Yeah. Thank you. So the first pasuk in Tehillim, Ashri Ha'ish Asher Lo Halach V'Atzas Hasha'im V'Derech Hatam Lo Amad U'V'Moshev Leitzim Lo Yashav. Person has to avoid the Rasha'im and avoid the Leitzim. Avoid the scoffers, the mimickers, the scorners, the Leitzim, the cynical ones, the sarcastic ones. So who are these Leitzim? Who's the prototype Leitz? Who's the prototype scorner? So Chazal said, source number base, U'V'Moshev Leitzim Lo Yashav Zekarach Shahim Mislotzeis Al Moshev Yarach. This is Korach who laughed and fomented and mimicked and scorned Moshe and Aaron. Now, what was the content of Korach? How did he foment? He was making dirty jokes. He was saying cynical comments. He was being sarcastic about Moshe. What do Chazal... Korach has many things, and we'll study Korach throughout the night. What were his mistakes? What was his great mistake? What led him astray? I mean, it's almost ludicrous to imagine, after all they've been through, after all the Makos and Mitzrayim, and all the liberation, and all the Yom Sof, and the Torah, and Moshe twice davening, and staving off elimination, and seeing the fate of the Ma'apilim who disobeyed Moshe's instructions. To ask yourself, what was Korach thinking? What led him into this place? And how could he even imagine that his challenge to Moshe would be successful? Moshe had been proven to be a supernatural man of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the young contested leader of Am Yisrael, dedicated to, what was he thinking? That's one question. We'll try to get a handle on that later, but once you see what he was thinking and you get into his mindset, how did he rally people? What was his rallying point? He had his own psychotic hallucinations, whatever he thought he could or couldn't, but how did he rally at least 250 leaders? We don't really know how many other people joined. It's Korach and Adasso. There's at least 250 others. There's Dasan and Aviram. There's an Omer ben Pallas who joins and somehow disappears. So it's not a small group. We don't know how much it stuck and took in the overall camp, as opposed to the Meraglim, which seems to have infected the entire Machaneh, V'Taragnu Be'Alechem, everyone's crying. It's hard to know, but he did succeed in fomenting a crowd. How did he get the crowd on his side? I mean, what's your selling point? So Korach was a really good demagogue. And demagogues are able to take particular details and amplify them and inflate them and create disproportion and lack of perspective. And that's really what Korach excelled at. And let's see Chazal, but I have to warn you, this could get very, very sad. We're going to read Korach's narrative. If you have some tissues nearby, it may pay to have a wad of tissues just in case you can't control your tears. Because listen to the story he tells, it's going to be a real tearjerker. So what's Korach's strategy? Shai mislotzeis al Moshe. Maisa kinas alem kol. He gathers an entire crowd. It sounds like it is starting to spread. And we think Leitzanus is cynicism. We think Leitzanus is sarcasm. We think Leitzanus is joke. There's nothing joking about this. There's nothing humorous about this. We'll see where humor and cynicism is associated with this. But Korach's not telling jokes. Korach's not a stand-up comedian. Korach's telling a story. I'm Lahan, line number three. Almana achas haisa b'shchunas. I know this widowed woman in my neighborhood. V'imashtei naros yisamos. And she was left widowed with two orphan daughters. And she was hungry. She was penniless. She was starving. She was desperate. V'haylo sada achas. And all she wanted to do was plant some corn, plant some wheat, and feed her starving orphan children. Line number four. Bas lachor, she decides to plow. Amala Moshe. Imagine Korach is mimicking Moshe, is pantomiming Moshe. If Moshe has one of these handlebar mustaches, it's all greased up. Ha ha ha! You want to plow? You have a nothing thing coming. Probably talked to her in a misogynist way. Lady, you want to plow? Amar la Moshe, lo tacharosh b'shor v'chamor yachtav. I'm going to prevent your plowing, you orphan lady with or widowed lady with two orphan children. That's my entire agenda, to thwart your plowing. Line number five, Bas Lizro. Now this priest, you see the hyperbole here? You see the exaggeration, that absurdity? He's creating polarity. All she wants, she's so moral, she's so kind, she's so desperate. And all Moshe can think of are measures to persecute her and to rob her of even the most basic human dignity of feeding your own orphan children. Now she wants to plant. Amar la Moshe says, got you again. Sadcha lo tizra kilayim. Be careful, don't plant the grains and the grapes too close. So now she follows Moshe's strict and suffocating instructions. Bas Lizro, all she wants to do is harvest whatever little she could plant and sow based on Moshe's suffocating and suppressive restrictions. V'lasa sarema. Amar says, I got you again. Leket, shichacha, peah, you're collecting. It goes to me. It's mine. It's all mine. Baslasa goren. Then she wants whatever little fruit is left over, or the little produce, she makes a goren. Moshe says, I'm right here. Truma, meiser, meiser rishon, meiser tzeni. Maybe Aaron gets into the act. Aaron, Moshe's twin brother, with an even longer handlebar mustache and even more seedy little eyes and even more grease in his hair. She says, you know what? Listen to the story. It's a real tearjerker, right? You know what? She says, I can't make this. There's no way I'm going to feed my children with this field. The restrictions are too all-encompassing. Moshe Rabbeinu is too wily. He's too dastardly. He's got a halacha for every possibility for me even to eke out a little living. So you know what I'll do, she says? Hitztika le'asadin. I'll just accept this harsh, seemingly inflexible set of laws. Ma'asa amdo machras asada v'lachashdekava. So you know, I'll sell my field, which is always a bad choice. So she's already being forced to act in an economically irresponsible fashion, to sell your field for two sheep. I'm on the sheep side. I'll take that deal any day. You want to sell me? You want to sell me your field? I'll get you three sheep if you want. Better to get real is I'll get five sheep. So she already has to, her position is leveraged out because everyone knows that no one wants this land because Moshe's waiting on it. Moshe's leaning on you. Moshe's a mafioso, so all she can get is two sheep. And she says, you know what? I can't really feed my family, but let them at least be warm in the winter. I'll sell them a couple sweaters. They're not going to eat that much, but they'll have some milk to drink. At least I'll shrink it down to its bare minimum. What happens? Kivin Shialdu. Second those sheep give birth, who enters the scene? Ba'ara, Moshe's sidekick, Moshe's wingman. Be'amarla, T'nilias abachoros. I get them. They're all mine. Me, not you, lady. Shekach amarla kadosh baruch hu. Kol abachor, ashei vale. You get the drift? Hitzika lasadin. Nasala sala vladas. He gives mangziza. So she says to give up the firstborn, but she still has the second and thirdborn. Now it's winter. It's freezing outside. Seasons are changing. You can see the snow. Clouds are turning dark gray. All she wants, the gaziza. She gets her wool. Aaron says, smiling in the background, pay up, woman. Pay up, you lady. I get my tenth. Shekach amar kadosh baruch hu. Reishis gei tzonchan. In the shir. So Moshe says, you know what? I can't even feed my poor little orphan children. You know what? We're about to tank. This ship's about to capsize. At least one last meal. At least one last meal. I can't plant. I can't provide milk and wool. Let me just at least shecht the animal. Give my kids one last good steak meal before they starve to death. So she says, "In bikoch lamod bishazem harini shochatan darchlasan kimin teshachta amrla tenila zroa lachayim v'keva pay up." She says, you know what? At least let me get a tax deduction. At least let me give it to Hektish. At least let me give it as a cherem. I'll do something good with my money. I'm about to die from this world. She says, cherem, she says, it's all. Who comes walking in? Aaron says, now it's all mine. Cherem ekar, because you said the word cherem. It all goes, brings up his Brinks truck, opens the doors, slams it on the woman. She's sitting there crying, watching the Brinks truck drive away with Aaron smoking on some big puffy hoagie, laughing his way to the bank at this poor woman's expense. Well, this is comical, of course, but you'd be surprised. You'd be surprised how through exaggeration and insult and caricature and pantomime, these are really good demagogues. You've seen good demagogues. I met good demagogues. There's no basis to truth. There's no basis to fact. They'll say whatever needs to be said. They'll paint pictures in distorted fashion. Again, I keep telling you, say what you want to say about the President of the United States. You may like his policies. You may even like his values. Who knows what his values are on abortion? You could. But you can't argue about his character. You can't argue about the way he manipulates, the way he insults, the way he exaggerates, the way... That's not an argument. You want to be the biggest supporter? You want to be a Trump rally? You want to support... That's fine. So you know what? The man's a monster, but I think that a politician does have to be a moral example. That's a tenable position. It becomes so simplistic. I was a little bit, I'll be honest with you, a little bit troubled when Trump was elected, how troubled people were. Because he's our role model, and how can he be our role model? The President of the United States shouldn't be a role model. Affirmed Jew has better role models. You have people in your Masari, your family, your rabbi, whoever. You shouldn't be sitting there delicately perched upon this precipice. Oh my goodness, the POTUS, or whatever he's called, he's... Well, we answer to higher authorities. We think even if you have a President of the United States who can act as a role model, and there are that can. Okay, so you have an extra one, but it's not as if you've lost your main asset in moral education. It's not as if the President of the United States is more moral, is less moral. We have higher and more transcendent role models in our life. Okay, so you could feel that somehow the messages we're delivering are a little bit compromised. It can't be this total panic as if, oh my goodness, the moral lodestar of our experience has now turned into a monster, an horrific moral reprobate. I was a little bit troubled by that. But you can believe that this man has good policies, and you can believe this man has good values, and even good people around him. This is not a political statement. But it's sad to see someone who's a demagogue. It's sad to see someone who insults people. It's sad to see someone who insults body parts. It's sad to see someone who exaggerates. That's just, it's far from the facts. It's far from... I'll tell you a cute story. I don't know if I told you this story before about my meeting with a demagogue. Didn't end so well, but it was a cute story. When I got back to YU in the 80s, it was a tough time at YU. The Rav was in retirement. There was a lot of politics swirling through the air. A lot of confrontations and clashes, and it wasn't for me. So I made one decision. I'm going to be under the radar. I'm going to be UTRs before we had these cute little phrases. Under the radar. I'm going to go learn, breathe, take my classes, get my degree, and leave Dodge City. I'm not getting stuck here in petty politics. And even to the point was, I used to go, I was telling someone the other day, I would go over, the commentator, it's a big YU student newspaper. It's always explosive, expose, scandalous, controversies. Let's read, everyone can't wait for the commentator to come out. I would go, they put the stack of papers before it was online, you got your paper. I go take my commentator, take my copy, rip it up, throw it in the garbage. I already wasted my copy. I don't have the right to read because it's one copy per student. So I already lost one. This is a public demonstration. I'm not going to get sucked into the vortex of the commentator and all its scandals. I'm going to be UTR, under the radar. No one's going to know my name. I think no one knew my name. I graduated Baruch Hashem nicely, but you didn't know I went through it. I ghosted YU. Who's this guy? Where's he getting marks? Who's he? I'm not in any pictures. Barely made the, what do they call it, the year, the yearbook. Calling me picture. I think they call me the last day. We need some quotes. I have to quote. These people have these highfalutin quotes, dressed for success, aim to be a great. I just, okay, whatever, listen to on the radio. So that's a good quote. No one really knew I was there. I was in and out. And certainly I wasn't sucked into any of the politics and demonstrations. Me, my svarim, my academics, my friends, my leftover food from Shabbos. Very, very humble life. Very humble, okay? And then there was one night that some organization invited Meir Kahana to come speak in yeshiva. All of a sudden, the basement is emptied out. Because Meir Kahana, aside from everything else, had very, very strongly insulted Rabbi Soloveitchik, had very strongly insulted Rabbi Schechter, had very strongly insulted Rabbi Lichtenstein in well-known documented articles. And we felt that, als kavod ha'Tora, we had to stand there and protest. This is not about politics. This is not about the state of Israel. This is about kavod ha'Tora. So the whole base matters him. There's a fascinating scene. Some of the people who are big Rosh Hashivas today, friends among, we said, we're going to pick it. And what can I tell you? We're such good picketers. We had such good experience. We're a little playing out of position. Okay, you play second base. I've never played him. Okay, try. Go make a picket. Go make a sign. I tried my best. I remember I made a big picture of Soloveitchik. Not too good on the art department either. a little, because Meir Kahana, one of his big claims was that all these Western American rabbis are tainting and diluting pure Judaism. Pure Judaism says kill the locals. And they're just too ethical. And they're importing. They are, this is a word, and and demagogues choose their words carefully and they become brand names. They are Hellenists. I give you a Hellenist living in 1985. We don't have sandals. We didn't even wear sandals those days. But go find a wreath for Hellenists. But that's what they do. I love people talk today. You're a fascist. Like, what? It's because you disagree with the opinion because you're a little more conservative. I'm a fascist. These are Hellenists. All of a sudden you take these brands and you superimpose. That's demagoguery 101. So he called up a Soloveitchuk a Hellenist because he had tainted pure Judaism because of Hellenizing influences from the West. He's a Hellenist. So I remember I drew a picture of a Soloveitchuk with a little quote, you know, those quote bubbles. Am I a Hellenist? Like, you know. Anyway, you know, it wasn't so successful. Anyway, so we picketed outside as he walked in. And then in, I remember my Jackter was a very, very prominent member of the picketing team. If I'm not mistaken, I think it was Sarolowski. So I don't remember exactly who, but we all empty. We were the picketers. This is our night to shine. This is our 15 minutes of fame. Anyway, so while he was speaking, so we also weren't just picketers, we were also hecklers. Right? We shifted from picketing to heckling when I walked inside. So he raised the crest, raised my hand, and I made the cardinal mistake when you face a demagogue. Trust me, if you ever face a demagogue, you never want to ask a question. You have to make a declarative statement, and it'll tell you who was successful, and it has to be really yes or no binary. Because any question he'll turn, and any open-ended answer he or she will manipulate. Boy, was I taken to the woodshed that night. This is like, you think I took, you know, this is like my moment. Oh yeah, Shachwis is an A. This is my moment to be duped. I said, I have a question for you. Said, how come you're a Rebbe, and you say you're a Rebbe, you go around giving shiurim, and you present yourself as a Rebbe, and the only thing you talk about is killing people and killing Arabs, and like, why don't you ever give shiur on Miga Lahotzi? Why don't you ever give shiur on Tam Ki Ikar? I pulled up a couple sigyos. So that's a pretty good question. When people speak substantively and speak to you, it's a powerful question. You're not a rabbi. You're distorting your rabbi title just for a political agenda and a very, very violent political agenda. So he looks at me and says, young man, I was once young, what's your name? I said, I'm Moshe. He says, Moshe, you're invited to come to my yeshiva, and I'll give you shiur and Miguel Hotzir. And of course, he had 20 goons in the front that traveled with him. He brought a cheering section with him. He also brought two centurion guards sitting on either side of him. That's a demagogue. You're not speaking substantively. Learn the difference between people that speak substantively, and people that just speak in cliches, people that just take brands and apply them, that distort the facts, that exaggerate the facts, that collect stories, that are storytellers, that evade the issue. These are all the tools of demagogues. They don't speak, there's nothing substance to it. It's all just manipulation, jousting, character assassination, exaggeration, amplification. I remember I was in seventh grade, I was on the debating team in my seventh grade class, and I kind of blew it off the night before, like watching TV or something like that. So I came totally unprepared. And the other team got up there and said whatever they said. And we were like basically about to get crushed. You know, I wasn't too prepared. So I just got up and said, you obviously don't understand the essence of what we're here to debate today. Blah, 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 blah. By the time I finished, I was crying. We won the debate. That's demagoguery. I had nothing to say. I didn't respond to his points. I just like, you obviously don't. And like, I don't know. I started crying and we won the debate. Be prepared for people like that and say, stay on point. Stop giving me caricatures. Stop giving me stories of women. And that's what halacha is. Halacha is really a demonizing attempt. It's just a dastardly attempt to persecute women. Every system has its loopholes. We'll get to this a little bit later. Every system has situations in which the combination of factors can lead to distress of a poor, vulnerable woman. And then the halacha system will step in, and charity money will be donated to her, and she'll be supported. And every society is only as strong as its ability to deal with exceptions and people that fall off the grid and people that suffer. So as if Moshe Rabbeinu sat in the back room with the Kodesh Baruch Hu, let's script a world to torture orphan, widowed women. They scripted a world that supports people who learn Torah, support people who facilitate Avodas Hashem, supports Kohanim, supports Levim, supports poor people. And of course, the conglomeration of circumstances and the permutations can lead to a certain person being facing a very, very steep economic hurdle, and these measures perhaps exacerbating. So the measures will be relieved, the karma will be mochel, but you can't prove a system by its exceptions. You can't prove a system. A lot of people always like to find that, oh, you see that yeshiva because of that boy, you see that approach because of that person.
People like they can't prove Judaism by Jews. Sometimes Jews act in some very negative ways, and there's something called Judaism. There's something called a set of ideas, and sometimes those ideas aren't always lived. I mean, think of yourself. Think of the difference between how you view modern Orthodoxy. Again, I'm not here to say whether you should be or shouldn't be. You know, I despise any labels, but think about how dispirited you were about modern Orthodoxy when you came to Eretz Yisrael, and now when you're living in Eretz Yisrael, because you see, at least in the national religious world, which is a different world, you see a lot of overlapping values, and at least you see this is a system of values that if lived with passion and with dedication, maybe can work in some context, but it just, in many cases, you didn't see it implemented as successfully as you would like to. So maybe the system of values is, in theory, applicable, and in theory, viable and sustainable, but in practice, in my community, it wasn't implementable for this reason or for that reason. So that's a demagogue, and just learn not to be a demagogue. Learn not to speak in hyperbole and exaggeration and manipulation and exceptionalism is one case. Learn to be substantive. Learn to say your points, make your points without exaggerating. There's a lot of color in today's conversation. Everyone wants to be more colorful than this. Everyone's looking for that quick line. And it's fine in interactive conversation, but when they're a real serious conversation, in relationships especially, relationships need straight, monotone conversation. You don't need flamboyance, you don't need storytelling, you don't need exaggeration, you don't need poetry. You want to go and, well, why'd you say, so many of your communications you'll find with people get derailed because you said a word and that other person misunderstood the word. Why are you calling me? I didn't mean to call you that, I just meant to convey my point. Because the more abstract your words, the less unified and the less overlapping your understandings are. We both know what the word, I don't know, put is. I say put it on the table. Not too much vague about the word put. So I say put this on the table, I'm pretty clear. But if I start to use more metaphoric and like, then please deposit. What do you mean deposit? Why are you saying deposit to me? What am I, a bank? What are you talking to me that way? And all of a sudden, a person can get very insulted. So when we write poetry, we use abstract words because we want to collect multiple meanings. And abstract words invite multiple meanings. When you communicate to someone, you don't want multiple meanings. You want common communication. You want to be on the same page. So it's not just extreme demagoguery. It's also trying to make your communication as substantive and clear and direct. And it's a lot of exaggeration and a lot of amplification. Anyway, just to end the good story before. So we were getting plastered by Americana until one person got up. And today he's a very well-known rabbi, and I was involved in an interesting, nothing seedy, but some slight little scandal issue, and he was, but he was a very, certainly a pugnacious person, even in Sticha. I said in the way you see him, but I should only tell you who was around me. You know, names. But had a very exciting Sticha experience in YU, sitting in my little corner watching the world go around. But anyway, the guy sat right behind me. He got up. And he disguised himself as a supporter. So first of all, right off the bat, he didn't announce himself as a heckler. I was one of the hecklers. I was one of the protesters. They already knew I was coming. So they said, "Oh, Jack, we were the hecklers." So everyone tagged us. But he was sitting in the back nice and quiet, so he was a little ambush. He didn't announce himself, and he raised his hand and said, "Hello, my name is Rabbi so-and-so. I didn't say his name." And this, I'm just trying to get into the mood. He's a big shakla and talk like this. So I was trying to read a shach, and he'd be shmoozing. It's not like in the shmoozing section. Here was a big shmoozer. Leave me alone, trying to read the shach. Okay. Here you go. My name is so-and-so. I'm a bonded New York attorney. Talk like in a slow pause. I'm a bonded New York attorney. My number, whatever his legal number, is a lawyer. My number registered in the New York Attorney Bar, whatever. I'm willing to wager you a $10,000 bet, which will be legally binding, and I can draw it up in 2 minutes outside. And on June 23rd, 1972, in the Jewish press, on page 22, column 1, line 32, you said, and I quote, I was so amazed, and he just read it. And he said, "Are you willing to take that wager? Yes or no? $10,000. Said, here's your chance to make $10,000 if you're right." And then the guy got nothing to say. Because he basically stripped it to the bone. No place to run, no place to hide, no. Sometimes when you're a media, this is a world, one day you guys are going to have to pay me a lot of money for this corporate advice. And they pay consultants a lot of money to come in and give you corporate advice. In meetings sometimes, to cut through to the bone and to really reduce it, you got to say, okay, yes or no, are we doing this? Three options, which one are we choosing? Or else the conversation just goes off the reservation. You're talking about this idea, he or she's talking about that idea. Just to help a conversation ground and say, is this what we're doing or is that? Don't give me reasons. Don't get caught because your reason is different. Maybe a little different. Maybe a little similar. Just say, are we taking this policy? We not. Yes, no. Option A, option B, option C, or none of the above. So he basically forced the demagogue into a binary yes or no, and he capitulated. Of course, everyone started clapping because they were just trained to clap every time he opened his mouth. The point is, of course, I'm trying to help you avoid demagoguery in your own lives and other people. Obviously, demagogic conversation, which is a very colorful conversation, which doesn't really communicate and move a relationship ahead. But the origins of demagoguery, the seed of demagoguery is just an inflation or a magnification of something we all struggle with, and that's cynicism. And let's dissect cynicism, okay? Cynicism, sarcasm, without differentiating right now between the two, although they're different, is as follows. Every single fill-in-the-blank in this world, every single person, every single institution, every single experience has a flaw. We don't live in a perfect world. We all have pock marks. The world's full of acne. We're all living in this imperfect world. Now, the healthy response to people, institutions, experiences, a work of art, whatever, is to say, wow, that's beautiful. That's fantastic. What a great yeshiva. What a great rebbe. What a great person. Whatever it is. But you can always find the flaw. And the cynic amplifies the flaw. Not in the same way as demagoguery, that it's public and it's manipulative, but cynic therefore amplifies the flaw and tries to repudiate or to disparage the person, the system, whatever. Just look at the flaw. Just look at the flaw. Look at the failure. Look at the fail. And the truth is, the brighter you are, the easier it is, because the more analytic you are. Sometimes the less analytic you are, you just, oh, this is a really good experience, this is a really good person, this is a really good restaurant, this is a really good night, this is a really... But smart people are very analytical, they're very, it's like Gemara. Once you get trained to be analytical, it's second nature, so you're always able... I have an inborn dislike for comedians. It's hard for me to watch comedy, because I know what's going on in the core. I mean, there's some comedians I enjoy listening to, my wife and I listen to sometimes on YouTube or something. People are self-effacing. People are bringing them on themselves, making them. That I enjoy. But most of humor is exactly this type of cynicism. This ability to take these experiences in our life that we all process normally and healthily and enjoy, more or less, and flip it and unsettle it and taint it because of here's the flaw, and here's the thing that you're not noticing. I've noticed it for you. I'm going to blow it out of proportion. Because of that, I'm going to contaminate the overall experience. That's what Karach does. Again, Karach is a crowd, it's demagoguery, there's screaming and shouting and goons and cheering sections. But the core, again, if you strip it down to the bone, it's the same thing. Halacha is not a system that's abusive. Halacha is not a system that's manipulative of economically vulnerable people. The halacha system is meant to create social equality, justice, welfare state, helping people. Are there situations? Of course there are situations. It doesn't reflect the failure of the system. It just means that every system will have a loophole and every system will have a fail. And that's really the second part, the more well-known cynicism of Karach. What's the more well-known story? Not that he gathers people and tells the tale, but of the tzitzis. I've got a garment that's full of tchelos. It's dyed blue and through. Do I need to append blue dyed strings to the garment? Now, he's found the one situation that blue strings seem to be a bit unnecessary and even irrelevant, because the entire baguette is blue. Okay, 99% of people don't have blue baguettes, because it's very expensive to dye your baguette with tchelos. It's probably illegal, because it was reserved for aristocracy, for the base of Mikdash. So it was very, 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 very rare to find people walking around in authentically tchelos dyed shirts. And in that context, the tchelos as a string offsets with the other color of the garment and the wool and the cotton. And there's a meaning. Whatever the meaning is, we're not going to deeply dive into the tzitzis right now. It was last week's parsha. But if you deconstruct what I love about learning Maseches Menachos and tzitzis, is it really helps you deconstruct clothing and the role of clothing and how we build clothing and how it clothes us. And what does it mean to have a garment that then branches off, literally into branches, anaf, and into strings, and how does that reflect the halachic system? There's some very deep thought about clothing and structure and the architecture of clothing. Now, you found the one case. Great for you. You're so smart. I'm so impressed with you. You're really impressive with your brilliance. I can't tell you how impressed I am. Not really. I almost have to correct myself. Two people have to make sure that I'm giving them a fair shake, or rich people and smart people. Because I found too many rich people and smart people are cocky and arrogant. So it's almost as if I sink into that mode, what do I care? Tell me something that should move me, that should interest me, not your money and not your brains. Tell me who you are as a person. So I give people who are smart and who are rich an unfair shake. They're allowed to be good people, even if they have money. They're allowed to be good people. So you found the one case. I am so impressed by your research. You must be a PhD candidate. Not that I would care. And then what's the second case? A house that's full of Sifrei Torah. Again, most houses do not have, I don't mean Svar, but Sifrei Torah. How many Sifrei Torah can you own? Most people cannot own an entire Sifrei Torah. It's too expensive. So we just summarize or synopsisize the two primary parshios, Shema and Vayim Shema, right in one o'clock, put on the Torah, which is the entrance. You found the case that it seems silly. And of course, even in those cases, it's not silly because there's a fundamental difference between the house and the iconic entryway, which is the transition. You can have a house that's full of Svarim, but without a mezuzah on the doorway, there's something functionally missing. There's something about walking through. That's why the mezuzah is placed on a tilt. When someone does say, when you walk in, you should be able to look backwards and see it. It should be tilted at you or away from you, depending upon the Rishonim. So you can have a house full of Svarim. Without a mezuzah, there's something missing on the exit or on the entry. You can have a beged completely dyed with tchelas, but the string effect, as our Salvation talked about, the blue of illogic, because the sea is not really blue, and the sky is not really blue. Science will tell you they're transparent, they're colorless. So blue essentially is the experiential color, the phenomenological color that we experience when we're looking into vast, deep abysses that we can't peer through. So when I'm looking at this shirt, I'm not looking through an abyss, I'm looking at an object which is reflecting certain parts of the spectrum and absorbing certain parts of the spectrum. But I'm looking at deep waters, not really seeing, so it emits a blue hue. Looking at the atmosphere, I'm not really looking at all layers, so it emits a blue. So there's an impenetrability that blue represents, an illogical, an indecipherability. And white is the color of ration. So we take a blue string and we wrap it around the white string. So Soloveitchik said that the core of Judaism is rational, but it has to be contained in a wrapping of irrationality. If you understand, not everything will be understood. It's thrown out a million times, but it's just a nice metaphor. If you look at Rav Kahn, for instance, as he quotes Rabbi Soloveitchik. So you can have an entire bag of tchelas. It won't simulate the effect of tchelas strings. But a cynic is always looking to upend. Sarcastic, we always, oh yeah, that part, let me find the flaw. He or she, they're too fat, they're too short, they're too small, they're too loud, they're too this, they're too that. And then, rather than looking at the entire package, here's Hashem, what's next week's parsha? Chukas. So I'm sure by Balak time, this room will be even emptier than it is now. So, when Bilam is desperately, desperately trying to cough up a few curses, it's almost comical, he's trying to say something negative. And Hakadosh Baruch Hu inverts, he's got a voice inverter. Every word he says, Hakadosh Baruch Hu, so he says, you know what? Balak says, let's go to a little mountain on the side and look at them from there. And maybe you'll be venomous enough and hateful enough that you'll be able to cough out some curse, some infective. And what does he say to Bilam? Efes katseu tireh v'kulo lo tireh. Maybe in that mountain you'll see part of the camp. You'll look at I don't know, the bathroom, the latrines of the camp, the outhouses. Maybe you'll look at the Shevet, Shevet Dun, who was known to have some riffraff associated with it. You're not going to look at the whole picture. When you don't look at the whole picture, you only see the negatives. When you see the negatives, it's easier to amplify. So generally, where our minds are riveted on the negatives, the smarter we are, the easier it is. Everyone can find the negatives by negative experiences or people. What about positives? They have to be really smart to unearth, to dig out. It's like a negative shenefel of mapolis. It's like they weren't sachar with lamed aleph. You have to find it. You have to have a kalif to be machape sachar to find that negative. But you're smart, and you can find it, and you're funny, and you've shown everyone everything they believe in is really not worth believing in. So don't be a Korach, but be careful not to be a mini Korach, not to be Korach-esque. Korach is a demagogue, but the station right before demagoguery, the station on the train, right before the demagogue station, is a station of cynicism and sarcasm. And I've told you all this, we spoke about earlier in Elul, That's really one of the traits to try to nip in yourself, and to be very, very careful by association, especially the guys who aren't going to be in yeshiva next year, because next time right now is leaving. Be very, very careful about the friends you keep, very seriously. Friends should be filtered based on midos. Should be rude to people, you shouldn't be a snob, chas v'shalom, but at this stage of life, your midos are very, very strongly impacted by your friends. So be careful. Find friends not just based on how smart they are, how cool they are, or how, where they live. As pretty much in high school, you don't choose your friends. You're placed in this big potpourri of people, and you migrate with people who find yourself similar to. You're not really sure why that migration happened. Something internal. Your study partners live in the same place, spend time together on the bus coming in from who knows where. And all of a sudden, part of maturity is, who do I want to be friendly with? Who do I want to take as my friends? Who do I want to spend time with? And values are important, and not just values, but character traits, because they're contagious. And the more time you spend with people with a particular character trait, the more it rubs off on you. And be careful about that. Be careful about people that are just making fun, always sarcastic, and always denigrating. And I know why it's so intoxicating and so addictive, because you feel good about yourself, because you said a smart line, you said something witty, and all of a sudden people you think feel highly of you. They're not, they're just people. At some stages, just intimidated by intellect. So they don't think highly of you, they're probably just intimidated by you. That's apt to dissolve at some point, because intimidation is an experience we don't like living under. But even if they are impressive, that's not how you win friends. You shouldn't win friends based on how smart you are at the expense of other people. So this is the description of how Korach succeeds in drawing people into this mob. The prior question, which I skipped, is, well, what was he thinking? What was he thinking at night when he was looking in the mirror? When he put his head down in the pillow, he's like, why did he launch this? How can he make such a grievous error? Sometimes you see people acting so foolishly. What were they thinking? And my favorite line of a correspondent, Zechur Latov, one of the mainstream Jewish correspondents in the 60s and 70s and 80s in popular culture in America, is a woman named Barbara Walter. She's Jewish, of course, but you still have heard of her. So during the 90s, Bill Clinton was presiding over the single global power after the fall of the Soviet Union with a humming economy. I mean, there was never a better time in the 20th century to be president. And it was a cakewalk. You were the only power. Soviet Union fell. They were at your behest. You had a humming economy. Kind of like, no. And all of a sudden, he was caught in this terrible scandal. There was a high school intern who was working in the White House for the summer. And he was involved in naughty activities with her. And just so Barbara Walters was asked, well, what question are you going to ask Bill Clinton when you interview him? And she came with this great line. And sometimes you have to ask yourself, I want to ask him one question. What were you thinking? Like, you can go down as one of the best presidents in history. And now you're a laughingstock. You're a one line. You're a punchline. Right? You want to tell a good joke, even if you're not such a good comedian, like I'm not so good. She said that, Clinton! Ah! Yeah, that's me, a good comedian, say the name. Ah, oh, Bill Clinton, yeah, bro, we all know. It's a great one-liner punching bag. All of a sudden, you're the top of your game, top of history, Mount Rushmore candidate, Mount Rushmore 2, and now you're a punchline. High school intern. What are you thinking? So I always thought that was a good question to ask myself in life when you come across ludicrous behavior. Like, what was Carl thinking? I can even wrap my head around the Moroccan. They were sent for real accurate reconnaissance, real important intel. They spun it a certain way. They were bitter. They were unbelievable. But I can wrap my head around the Moroccan. It's so fearsome experiences. I know what it is to feel like you're facing adversity that you can't overcome. And how will you possibly... What was Korach thinking? Moshe? Right after Parsha Shlach, right after the Moroccan. If there's one person that gets a pass, if there's one person that... Everyone's favorite. How could you even believe it? So Chazal is a very, very haunting medrash. It's based on the Vayikach Korach. I'll paraphrase it. Essentially, Chazal say Korach was delusional. He took himself into a place beyond rational. Lakach Atzmo. Take a look at the medrash. Lakach Atzmo Litzad Acher. Now, why? So source number 5, this is a collection of sources, we're not going to get to all of them. Source number 5, part Aleph. Korach shepikeach ha'yemayra l'shtus hazeh. How do you allow his ration to be dislodged? How do you allow his reasoning to be distorted? Eino hitaso, his eyes confused him, his eyes deceived him. doesn't mean his eye, his optical eye, but his vision. Ra shalshalas gedola omed es himen. He had a premonition. He had a prophecy. In some sense that he was destined for greatness. He saw, wasn't as clear, maybe he wasn't a prophet like Moshe Rabbeinu, but he saw that his descendants would accomplish great things. So he bet on himself. He said, I can take any risk, and I can challenge any authority because I'm already locked in. I'm already part of history. I'm already written to the history books. And of course, we know the famous Medrash, which is associated with this, that while he's being engulfed, his children literally feel the vapors of hell singeing their nostrils, and they don't even say anything. They just open their mouths and they start thinking penitent thoughts, and a little shaft comes out on their way down, and they're rescued, and at some point they're reparated up to the surface. And they're responsible for various prakim and tehillim, Dal Matzeachlim, Vekarach, Mizmar. Probably the most famous parak is Parak Memzayin, which we recite 7 times before Tekiah Shah. Again, David compiles, but evidently they were involved in composing and articulating some of these phrases. So he has this sense that all these great things will come. Source number 512, Shmuel is his descendant. There are 24 Mishmaros, and he doesn't realize that he can be liquidated, his children survive, and the progeny continue, and his future still be fulfilled. Now, there really are two things here, two separate things. I want to parse this Medrash into two different messages. One is, and it's very hard to know how to calibrate between the two. On the one hand, I want you to feel that there's something special awaiting you in life, and that Hashem placed you at a particular historical perch, with particular historical expectations, with particular historical resources, to accomplish something beyond just a quiet life of self-sufficiency. So you're here for some reason. You didn't just get the gifts you were given, the talents you were given, just so that I could quietly make my money, eat bagels Sunday morning, and enjoy sports. You have to leave this world a better place. You have to be an Oved Hashem. You have to make some change. Whatever that change is, it could be grand scale and public, it could be private, that you're going to be a Talmid Chacham and raise your family based in Yerushalayim, whatever. But all of a sudden, stakes are higher, you're an adult now, process your life like an adult. Something great awaits you, potentially. But that premonition can also be very imprisoning. It can be very, very paralyzing. Because you don't live in the present. And every decision you make, well, how will that affect this great opportunity I have? And I can't compromise it. And if you want to read a very, very nice little novel, it was written by Henry James, British author at the end of the 19th century, who was the brother of William James, and in fact the subject of a very cute attempt by Rav Lichtenstein to be funny at a Chanukah Nesipa. Like, he was asking riddles and stuff, and he said, can you name me, like, we were talking to this Israeli share, two brothers lived in Britain at the end of the 19th century, one of whom was a philosopher who wrote novels, and one who was a novelist who wrote philosophy. And of course, no one got it. The answer was, William James was a novelist who wrote philosophy. Rav Aaron likes to say, the varieties of religious experience, William James. And his brother, Henry James, was a philosopher who wrote novels. So next time you have that challenge, maybe you'll be on Jeopardy or something. You'll come through in the clutch. William James and Henry James. Anyway, Henry James wrote a nice little novel, small novel, about 40, 50 pages, called A Beast in the Jungle. Beautiful little novel about a young man who has this great premonition that he will accomplish something fantastic in his life and something superlative. And that expectancy or expectation paralyzes him. He can't do anything because every decision is streamed not through ration, not through instinct. How do we make decisions? We assess, we trust our gut, what do I want to do, what makes sense to me. But once you add that extra equation in, well, how will this decision affect my ability to produce that great potential that I'm slated for? The whole decision-making process collapses because there's no way to know. So he's paralyzed, can't get married, can't make decisions, becomes basically inactive, passive, indifferent to any decision because, and the name of the book is about Beast in the Jungle. The Beast in the Jungle is this premonition that's crouching in the jungle, scaring him into paralysis, frightening him into inactivity. He just can't move, he can't begin. So life is a balance between articulating our decisions based on those future goals that we set for ourselves, but also living in the moment, being here in the present, and how am I responding? I talked about this a little bit with Yosef and Yehuda, having a premonition of how life should be, or responding to the way life presents itself. And we all have our narratives that we would like life to follow. We hope that more or less HaKadosh Baruch Hu allows our designs and our roots to more or less accommodate our expectations, but certainly there's deviances, sometimes there's sharp discrepancies, and life's about on the one end maintaining that objective, and then the other adapting to when the route changes, when there's traffic, you take another route, and all of a sudden all your expectations are debunked, and all expectations are rejected. So Karach's got this sense of, I've got this great potential, and it blinds him. It blinds him. It just doesn't read the tea leaves. I mean, where are you living? Which world are you living in? Living in the world of the desert, 2 years of Moshe Rabbeinu's rule, Maka. Just blinded. It's amazing to see how hallucinatory he is. It's amazing to see how blinding this sense of premonition about myself can be. That's why he's such a powerful member, because then we all go through that, and we're blinded to reality, blinded to the details, to the facts. The second part is we're not just blinded to the facts, but at some level, it's not just, are you reading the scene properly? But there's also moral lines which are being crossed. He's also offending Moshe. He's manipulating people. There's real manipulation here. When you read those Midrashim, he's manipulative. He's using people as his tools to achieve. There's a very, very, cacophonous assortment of people here. Korach's basically an intra-Levite political movement. He wants the intra-Levi powers to be distributed more equitably, Chazal tells us, because there were four sons of Kehas, Amram, Yitzhar, Chevron, and Uziel, and he thought that the power should be shared in a semi-equitable fashion, and yet the two children of Amram, Moshe and Aaron, are consolidating powers. And then the representative of the tribe of Levi, the representative of that tribe is Elitzaphan, who comes from Uziel. So his father, Yitzhar, gets passed over. So it's a very, very local question of political allocation within the tribe of Levi. Okay? And then you've got Dasan and Aviram, and they're just opportunists. I mean, they're just looking for opportunities to take a pound of flesh from Moshe. It could be in Mitzrayim, according to Chazal, the two people who were warring. It could be when the month's falling and they're trying to sabotage Moshe. But they're just looking to join. And the 250 people, according to some versions, they were the deposed Bechorim, so they've got their own axe to grind. Maybe they were being... But all of a sudden, you've got a strange bedfellows. You wake up in bed, people, you didn't go to sleep with them, and they're sitting right next to you snoring with bad breath. And where did I end up tonight? Who are these people, the drunk people next to me? And you're wondering, strange bedfellows. And the conductor of this very, very literally cacophonous orchestra is Korach, who's keeping everyone in line, basically using people. Basically, it's real exploitation. Anytime you use someone for an objective that really isn't theirs, it's yours, but you're just employing them and using them as a shovel to dig your own interests. So Korach is not just a developmental tragedy. How could you be so blind? The Bill Clinton story. How could you be so blind to history calling you and ignore how this indiscretion is going to torpedo all your accomplishments? But it's also moral, and I spoke about this earlier in the year, that ambition is such a powerful and dangerous trait, because it forces us to cross all sorts of moral red lines, because it doesn't present itself as some of the other toxic traits do. And when we feel lust, let's face it, you know that it's unholy. You know that it is corrosive. Sometimes you're stronger, sometimes you're weaker. When you feel jealousy, you feel petty, you feel low. You don't always self-assess. Sometimes your desire for someone else's achievements or material wealth is too overwhelming. But you know you're involved in the dark side of human experience. When you feel, anger. Anger's not a good feeling. Your palms start to sweat. Your diaphragm starts to rise. It's not a good feeling. You're controlled by something larger than yourself. You just stop in the moment and say, what am I feeling? You pull out. But ambition is very different. It's flexible. It appends itself to your noble ideas. And it convinces you that you're not acting out of personal ambition. You're acting for something larger. I'm acting on behalf of the Jewish community. And if I'm not the president of the shul, the community will collapse. If he becomes the president of the shul, he's now the president. I've got to unseat him. It's not about me. It's about everyone else. And if I don't address and advance myself, it's not only, I have news for you. I'm being serious now. It's not only the Jewish world that will suffer. The entire free world will collapse. If I don't give the Dvar Torah Friday night at the Shabbaton. I mean, it's not about me. But come on. We all know. It's world chaos. I mean, nuclear wars. I have to give the Dvar Torah. Because that guy gives the Dvar Torah. They're pushing buttons in Arkansas and setting off silos of nuclear warheads. Okay, I may be demagogic because I like to be that way also in my own way. But that's why it's so dangerous, because you convince yourself. So Shmuel's not just, Korach, Shmuel says that. Korach is not just on the delusion train, because he's got this premonition of grandeur and he's sunk into delusions. He's also on the ambition train. And ambition will push you across because you are justifying means from left to right, because that end is so holy in your self-described narrative that all the means justify all whatever end you're serving. And basically, it's really, really hard in life. So many times, I don't care about what it means to accomplish out there. There are many people who are very accomplished out there, and they're monsters. I know them better. I mean, I live long enough to know these people. And people that are in headlines and in newspapers and what goes on behind the scenes. So what happens out there doesn't impress me. It's what happens in here, we are as a person. It's very, very rare to find cases in which the end justifies the means. Generally, if you're looking for one of the classic, inalienable moral codes, when I say moral cause, you have to give up accomplishment. You want to be a politician in today's world. In most cases, you have to be cutthroat. In most cases, you have to be manipulative. In most cases, you have to be aggressive. Okay, you'll get headlines. You may be a better person for it. So you convince yourself that you're going to make such important changes to the world for your political position that all of a sudden, I don't know. The world's pretty much heading where it's heading anyway. That is all of a sudden your policies, Democratic. The purpose of democracy is to eliminate politicians. That's basically the point. If we could just have a democracy with enough, I remember telling my kids 2 elections ago, now they're realizing how right I was. That's me, Abba, who are you going to vote for? 2 elections. I said, no, I don't know if I'm going to vote. I just trying to wake them up a little bit. I said, what do you mean, Abba? I said, it's not going to make any difference. So you really think that it's going to make much of a difference? Pretty much who we are is who we are. We don't have that much room internationally. It's not like a right-wing government is going to build more and a left-wing is going to build less. It's not like a right-wing government is going to put more into the military and a left-wing less. Pretty much reality is dictating. I said, Abba, that's so undemocratic of you. I said, no, quite the opposite. That's the most democratic statement I can make. Because the idea of democracy is to reach such a consensus at a national level that it pretty much doesn't make a difference. And you're locked into this is what we need as a people. But you also get the elections, 35-35, and then a couple parties here. So those are the realities. And more charismatic, less charismatic, more political manipulation, less political manipulation. It's not going to make much of a difference. And thank God. Thank God we have a country that's strong enough to support democracy, independent of its leaders. And I think if he's a good leader, maybe yes, maybe not because of any great policy, not such great political mind. Maybe he's a good handler. You could argue, you could disagree, but those are the realities. And you can't legislate reality. So, but what will you do to yourself? What moral damage would you do to yourself by entering that field? Okay, so I'm not discouraging. You want to be a politician, just be careful at a certain point. You're looking in the mirror and you say, it's either my soul or my political appointment. Prioritize your soul. Because political appointment is mortal and temporal. Your soul is immortal. So don't sacrifice. Remember we talked about every sacrifice of eternal values for temporal values is always a bad exchange. Remember I told you I'd get in on that deal and sell my 3 sheep for the land? I would not sell my soul for success. That's a bad one. Success comes and goes, and 200 years, I can know who you were. But 200 years, you have your soul to deal with, and your identity, and your values, and that's something you don't want to compromise for temporal, immediate gain. Okay? Okay, well, this talk is making me hungry for falafel.
Who's calling me? Okay.
Thank you.
You're welcome.